come up on a tight wire.
I'm sitting across from my good friend Benjamin Alira-san.
And I'm sitting across from my good friend Daniel Chacon.
Welcome to another edition of Words on a Wire.
Our guest this week is
Jessica Soffer, whose new novel is getting rave reviews, a lot of attention, and it's called Tomorrow There Will Be Apricots. And it's a story about Iraqi Jewish woman in New York City. Very interesting.
Very, very interesting.
And she'll be joining us. And then our poem of the week, Benjamin Alira-san is going to read from one of his books, Dreaming the End of War, right?
Right.
It's going to be a good show. Stick around.
So, Daniel.
Yes.
It's summer.
Hot down, summer in the city.
Ah,
I can't think of summer without thinking of that song.
Really?
Yeah.
You know mine is?
What?
School's out for summer.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Summertime.
And the living is easy. But we've done that already on this
yes,
show.
Yes, we have. Anyway, you're going to ask me something about summer.
Summer. And a lot of times, summer is also for reading, especially
for
us.
Oh, yes. Because we get to read stuff that we don't have to teach.
And you know what? I am going to read stuff that I have to teach, but it's something that I like. But you know what? It's stuff I really love.
Absolutely.
I'm teaching a Faulkner seminar in the fall.
Oh, you get to read Faulkner over the summer.
And I really want to spend time with them, and because some of them are very difficult.
Yeah, absolutely.
We're reading The Sound and the Fury, Go Down Moses, Absalom, Absalom, As I Lay Dying, and a couple of other works. And they're really, in some ways, difficult. I don't find them difficult anymore because right. I'm so familiar with them. But I know that it can be very tough reading at times. You know, what I love about Faulkner is that he's so baroque in his language. He just goes on and on and on. He is not the least bit a minimalist when it comes to his writing style. He's the opposite of Hemingway.
Can you guess what my favorite Faulkner chapter is? I haven't memorized. I'll recite it right now. Can you guess what it is? My mother is a fish. That's the whole chapter. You know, I have a problem with Faulkner. I think he's a genius, but it reminds me of Lorca and Neruda. They were doing a poetry reading in Buenos Aires together, and apparently, this is what the legend is, Neruda said to Lorca, "Stop! Stop reading! You influence me too much." And that's my problem with Faulkner. Every time I read Faulkner, I come up with these really long sentences, and it's I can't help but be influenced after I read him. Do you find that's the case for you when you read a lot of Faulkner?
Well, I have found that Faulkner has been an influence on me. I can be very, very spare in my writing, particularly in my dialogue. But I can go on and write these long Faulkner-esque sentences because he is an influence. I'm not trying to imitate him.
Right, right.
I have
my
own voice.
Absolutely.
And I'm not trying to imitate Hemingway when I'm being a minimalist because I have my own voice. But they have been really big influences on me. And our reading always does. What are you reading this summer?
Well, you know, if I can finish with this Faulkner thing, the problem with me when I read one of my favorite books ever is The Sound and the Fury. I mean, it's just one of the most amazing works of written art ever. But I can't read it again because when I do, it's like there's a spirit that overtakes me and I'm trying to write. And suddenly I'm doing the Quentin chapter, which I think is the most beautiful part of the whole book.
Who reappears in Absalom, Absalom.
Yeah. I just can't do it anymore. I just can't read Faulkner anymore. And I remember when I was in grad school, I had read Sound of the Fury for the first time. And I was also taking a fiction writing workshop with Steve Yarbrough, the novelist, and I wrote this story called In the Valley of the Whale. And I had some Faulknerian flourishes there. And I thought it was the most brilliant story I've ever written in my life. And Steve Yarbrough, you know, who's from Georgia, he says, "Diane, just let Faulkner be Faulkner."
Yeah, yeah. And what are you reading this summer?
You know, this summer I'm just going to read a lot of poetry. I'm going to be in Spain part of the year or part of the summer, and I think what I'm going to do is I'm going to pick up some, what I did last time when I went there, go to the bookstores and find some contemporary Spanish poets and just immerse myself in what is being published right now in Spain.
And if you come over to my house, I'll lend you a few books.
Awesome.
Poems.
I will do that. I'll be there. But first, we'll talk to Jessica Soffer.
So stay tuned.
Thank you.
We're talking to Jessica Sofer, whose new novel, Tomorrow There Will Be Apricots, just came out. Jessica, welcome to Words on a Wire.
Thank you so much for having me.
And congratulations on this lovely book, Tomorrow There Will Be Apricots. And I'd like you to, if you can, just tell us a little bit about the book. But first, that title, where does that title come from?
Well, Tomorrow There Will Be Apricots is an Iraqi phrase. It's an Arabic phrase, but the Iraqi Jewish population used it quite a bit to reference the apricot season, which was very short and very fickle and sometimes never came at all. And so it means a number of things. It means don't put off tomorrow what you can do today. It's sort of melancholy, but equally so, it's hopeful. Mm-hmm. And I think that speaks to the novel at large, which is a weird combination of somber and joyful.
Absolutely.
And so in some ways, it's that hopeful part was almost like saying next year in Jerusalem.
Exactly. Exactly.
Tell us a little bit about the book.
Well, it's a story of two women, a young girl, a 14-year-old pain addict named Lorca, who has a very cold, distant mother who's a chef, and an 85-year-old Iraqi Jewish widow named Victoria, who has just lost her husband when the book begins, and who is looking for the child that she gave up for adoption many years before. And they find themselves sort of thrown together through cooking classes, Iraqi Jewish cooking classes in New York City.
In the first chapter, it reveals Lorca, the young girl, who cuts herself, inflicts a lot of pain, and she gets caught doing it. And so the mother is really kind of just fed up, and she's about ready to send Lorca off to, I don't know, a home or somewhere. But then Lorca discovers, and this ties the novel together, I love this, Maskouf. Is that, am I saying it right?
Yes, you're saying it perfectly.
Can you tell us what maskouf is exactly?
I can. Maskouf is the national dish of Iraq, and it's a grilled fish dish. It's pretty simple, just made with lemon, sometimes tamarind, sometimes onions, pickled onions or tomatoes. And it's a very nostalgic dish for the Iraqi Jews. It was traditionally made on the banks of the Tigris and Euphrates, where it was just whisked out of the rivers and grilled right there by fishmongers. And it's a very nostalgic dish for a number of reasons, the most obvious being that that dish can no longer be eaten in the way that it once was. There was a fatwa declared on those fish because of all the dead bodies that were floating in those rivers, and Baghdad isn't what it used to be. And so for the Iraqi Jews, to reference that kind of food, that kind of eating, is just a real sore spot.
And she's really surprised when she finds out her mother, who is a chef, who's an excellent chef, and I mean, they love cooking. Everybody in this book cooks. But she's really surprised when she finds out that her favorite meal was this. And so she seeks throughout the pretty much the rest of the book reconcile her mother by making this perfect dish for her.
That's right. She's desperate to find the key to her mother's happiness, and more specifically, hoping that the key to her mother's happiness will have something to do with her. All she wants is to please her, to make her happy. And the fact that she didn't know about this dish, had no idea that it existed or that her mother loved it as much as she does, really gives her this kind of in. And she hopes that finding the recipe and being able to perfect it will get her her mother's love in a way that she hasn't had it before.
How did you stumble upon the idea for this book?
Well, I started it with a story I wrote during when I was in graduate school, and it was a story of a woman's life of self-harm from the time that she's a young girl to the time that she's an adult. And the story didn't really work, but I found the character to be quite compelling, and that character really was Lorca. And I decided that when I wanted to work on a larger work, that she would come with me. I wanted to unpack her further, I guess, is the way that people talk about these things. And then pretty soon on into the writing process, this image popped into my head of two women cooking together in a kitchen, and one was a young girl and the other was an old woman. And that's sort of how Victoria came to me. I had always known that I wanted to write about my father's culture, which is the Iraqi Jewish culture. And I also knew that I needed to sort of counterbalance the voice of Lorca, which is very, very young, very full of life, also very full of sorrow, with something on the other end of the kind of life spectrum that had the weightiness that I was after and could kind of illuminate the other side of Lorca in a way that felt important.
How long did it take you to write this book?
It's hard to say. I mean, there were so many iterations of it in a lot of ways. Probably, I would say 3 years, and then including publishing and things on either end, probably 4 years in total.
Was it difficult for you to sell the book?
It was in certain ways, and it wasn't. I mean, I've been quite lucky, I think. I published a story right after I graduated from graduate school in Granta, and it kind of got me enough attention so that when I was looking for agents, I didn't have to really seek them out in the traditional way. I already had contacts, and they kind of knew who I was, and that was really nice. And then I worked on the book for quite a while with my agent, and eventually we sent it out to be sold. And I think it's a tricky book because there is a lot of sadness to it. I think that there's a lot of joy to it, but on the most superficial level, I think it's probably a little bit of a downer. And so, yeah, I think in certain ways it was a difficult book to sell, but I've been incredibly lucky. I'm being published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt here in the U.S., and I'm really just blown away by the generosity of everybody there, specifically my editor, who just really gets better and better day by day. She just has blown me away.
You're right. There is a lot of sadness in this. There's a lot of grief. But as we're learning about Lorca's addiction, and as we're learning, or that first chapter with Victoria and her husband, as he's dying, and then at the end of the chapter, he actually dies, and she realizes that's what she's been waiting for. But the sequence with Dottie, and the sequence with Aunt Lou, and all those things kind of gives it this underlining humor that causes the narrative not to really bog down in grief or sadness, but to move along, kind of, I don't want to say lightheartedly, but with humor.
I'm glad that you say that. I'm really glad that you say that, because a couple of people have understood the book as simply dark, and I don't think that's what it is, and I don't hope that's what people take away from it. I mean, I think that there are these kind of peripheral characters whose, not job in the novel, but certainly what they do is bring a certain sense of lightheartedness, as you say. But more than that, I think the book is concerned with what happens after sadness, that there is a kind of progression of things, that there are very, very dark times, but then there is light afterwards, and the lightness can mean that much more, having gone through all the gray.
Yeah, and tomorrow there will be apricots, darn it.
Yeah.
We're talking to Jessica Sofer, whose new novel, Tomorrow There Will Be Apricots, just came out. I want to ask you about the name Lorca. I mean, obviously, we are not going to be able to not think of Garcia Lorca. And, of course, he's referenced quite a bit in the novel. But there's this image in the middle of the book where she's in a bookstore, and a friend of hers is trying to show her this Dalí book of an image he did for Lorca. But there's a pile of Marilyn Monroe books on top of it, and she has to keep going through those images of Marilyn over and over in order to get to that. It's a lovely scene, and in many ways it kind of speaks a lot about Lorca herself. Can you tell us a little bit about that scene or that image itself?
Yeah, thank you so much for remembering that scene. I really enjoyed writing that scene and feel like it really speaks to the character of Lorca. She has this friend named Blot, who's a guy who works at a bookstore, and they're kind of two lost souls thrown together in this way. And he is giving her this book, and there is this stack of Marilyn Monroe books. And every time she looks at another one, she's kind of reminded of all of her insecurities, the ways that she doesn't feel particularly womanly or feminine or strong in the way that Marilyn Monroe seemed at one time. And I think that more than that, she's just desperate for a connection in any way to Blot, of course, to her mother, of course, but also to her name. She feels like her parents must have put some thought into that name. It's such a particular name, and she just wants someone to explain to her what that means and how a name can be so meaningful to a child. It can carry so much weight, and no one really gives that to her. And so in any way, she's just looking for someone to tell her, your name is a name of love, it was passed along to you for a specific reason, and you should feel really cherished because of it. And so she finds that in Blot in certain ways.
And do you read Lorca?
I have read Lorca. I studied Spanish for a long time. I was a Latin American studies major in college, and I think Spanish is such a beautiful language, and it was sort of, when I first started studying Spanish was when I really became concerned with language, I think more than ever, and particularly, I mean, Spanish poetry and Spanish literature is just a joy to read in a way that almost is better than American literature for me, because I think it requires a certain level of thought on my part that I don't have to do when I'm reading in English. And so you really kind of break things down and consider the language and all of its flourishes in a different way.
So do you think your reading and your studying Latin American literature actually turned you into a writer?
In certain ways. I mean, it's hard to say what in particular turned me into a writer, but I would say a whole mess of things did. And early on, I always have been concerned with language, but I think studying Spanish, and I studied Latin for many years, was a way of just kind of refocusing my energy, refocusing the way that I saw language.
I'm going to predict two of your fictional influences. I don't know if I'm right, but I can see them in here. One is Flannery O'Connor, and the other is Roberto Bolaño.
That is so beautiful. Thank you. What an honor, and what a very smart thing to say. Well, absolutely.
The reason why I see Flannery O'Connor is because you have these incredible character details that you're able to get by in one sentence. Like, for example, the towel sat like a turtle on her head, its feet pushing and bending her ear. That's such a Flannery O'Connor type of detail. And you're able to really just characterize somebody so quickly. And I love that about your writing.
Thank you. That's so very nice. Yes, Flannery O'Connor is absolutely an influence. I'd say a lot of the Southern sort of Gothic writers are. And I think that they do marry humor and darkness in a way that I wanted to get at. So, yes, thank you.
That kind of reminds me of an image in an O'Connor story, Good Man is Hard to Find, with the one of the characters has this scarf, and it looks like rabbit ears.
Yes,
And then the Bolaño, where I see the Bolaño, is the plot itself, the intrigue itself, it starts with this dish. And really that kind of that investigation throughout is very Bolaño-like, in the sense where usually, you know, like one of his characters might discover an obscure writer or something and starts the search, and then the whole novel unfolds around that.
Yeah, there's a compulsiveness to Bolaño that I sort of see in myself and I see in my writing too, this kind of obsessive behavior on the behalf of his characters. I love that. And there's also a chattiness to it, like a self-referential way that they kind of talk about their obsessions and their neuroses. It feels like something I'm constantly trying to go after.
Right. And what is the most difficult thing for you about writing?
That's a good question. I actually have to say that the writing isn't really the hard part for me. I mean, of course, there are days that it's hard, and I'm a terrible plottist, so I could say that's hard. But I think that this part, actually, of the process has been the hardest, the kind of letting go of the novel, realizing that it's going to be in other people's hands, that there's not all that much I can do, is really a terrifying part. And I think there's also a kind of melancholy that sinks in when you realize that the thing that you love the most, you've turned into a career, and in a way kind of bankrupted it. That's a little bit of what's difficult. Right now is a hard moment in a lot of ways. It's a really gratifying moment. It's so amazing that the book is in people's hands and that they're telling me what they think, good or bad. But it's also really terrifying, and I feel suddenly naked in a way that I wasn't prepared for. I don't think you can really prepare for this moment.
Well, you're doing really well. I mean, you're getting a lot of press on this. You got a nice blurb from O Magazine, and you've been getting a lot of good coverage for it. So I imagine you're in the spotlight right now.
Oh, I don't know. I guess so. I mean, really all I want to do is write another book. I've realized how desperate I am to start that again.
Have you started?
I haven't started another novel. I have one sort of percolating, but nothing has been written down quite yet.
You've grew up in New York City. From what I understand, you wrote this blog for the New York Times. You grew up a pretzel's throw away from Central Park.
I did.
Love that detail. Obviously, you know, New York City, it plays a big part in your writing. Have you ever lived in a cow Hampshire? Which is one of your characters called New Hampshire, or any place outside of New York, or are you just like, you're straight up New Yorker?
In my defense, I have left for brief periods. I did live in very rural Costa Rica for on and off for 2 years, and I went to college in Connecticut. Mm-hmm. And quite recently, my boyfriend and I have sort of moved to Eastern Long Island, although it's transitional at the moment. But I have lived out of the city, but I do feel like a New Yorker. I feel like New York will always play a part in my writing in one way or another. And in Apricots, New York City very much feels like a character to me. It feels like it holds as much kind of weight and importance as the other characters do.
We've been talking to Jessica Sofer, whose fantastic and lovely novel, Tomorrow There Will Be Apricots, just came out. Jessica, I have to congratulate you on one thing. You're a very good writer. You have the incredible instinct and for a first book, and the fact that you didn't separate the chapters by recipes. Thank you for not doing that.
Oh, you're welcome.
Were you ever tempted to do that or even thought about it?
I didn't actually even think about it. If it occurred to me, I might have lost this compliment entirely, but I'm glad it pleased you.
Yeah, yeah. Well, anyway, thank you so much for joining us on Words on a Wire. It's a great book, and we wish you all the success.
Thank you so much. It's been a real pleasure.
Yes, and congratulations.
Thank you.
عبور عاشقی از ابر و مهتاب، عبور عاشقی در ابر و مهتاب، سکوت شوق من در سایه خواب، صبوحی پر شده از آب انگور.
For this week's poem of the week, I'm going to read one of my own poems, and it's a poem from Dreaming the End of War, and it's called The Fifth Dream, Bullets and Deserts and Borders. A man is walking toward me. He is alone. He has been walking through the desert. He has been walking for days. He has been walking for years. His lips are dry and cracking, like a piece of spent soil. I can see his open wounds. His eyes are dark as a Tanzanian night. He discovers I have been watching, though he has long ceased to care what others see. I ask him his name, ask him what has brought him here, ask him to name his angers and his loves. He opens his mouth to speak, but just as his words hit the air, a bullet pierces his heart. I do not know the country of this man's birth. I only know that he is from the desert. He has the worn look of despair that only rainless days can give. That is all I know. He might have been born in Jerusalem. He might have been born in Egypt. He might have been the direct descendant of a pharaoh. His name might have been Ptolemy. His name might have been Moses. Or Jesus, or Mohammed. He might have been a prophet. He might have been a common thief. He might have been a terrorist. Or he might just have been another man destined to be worn down by the ceaseless, callous storms. He might have come from a country called Afghanistan. He might have been from Mexico. He might have been looking for a well. His dreams were made of water. His lips touching water. Yes, that is what he was dreaming. I can still hear the sound of the bullet. The man reappears. It does not matter that I do not want him in my dreams. He is searching through the rubble of what was once his house. There are no tears on his face. His lips still yearn for water. I wake. I begin to believe that the man has escaped from Auschwitz. Perhaps he sinned against the Nazis, or because he was a collaborator, or because he was Jewish, or because he loved another man. He has come to the desert looking for a place he can call home. I fall asleep trying to give the man a name. The man is now walking toward a city that is no longer there. I am the man. I see clearly. I am awake now. It is me. It has taken me a long time to know this. I am a Palestinian. I am an Israeli. I am a Mexican. I am an American. I am a busboy in a building that is about to collapse. I am attending a Seder, and I am tasting my last bitter herb. I am a boy who has learned all his prayers. I am bowing towards Mecca in a house whose roof will soon collapse on my small frame. I am a servant. I shine shoes and wash the feet of the rich. I am an illegal. I am a Mexican who hates all Americans. I am an American who hates all Mexicans. I am a Palestinian who hates all Israelis. I am an Israeli who hates all Palestinians. I am a Palestinian Jew who hates himself. I am dying of all this knowledge. I am dying of thirst. I am a river that will never know water again. I am becoming dust. I am walking toward my home, Mexico City, Washington, Mecca, Jerusalem. I don't know. I don't know. I am walking in the desert. I see that I am reaching a border. A bullet is piercing my heart. That was from my collection of poems, Dreaming the End of War. This is Benjamin and Lita Sainz with the Poem of the Week.
پرستو به اوج آسمونت افق ها سای روشن گرم خونت.
We'd like to thank Jessica Sofer for talking about her beautiful novel, Tomorrow There Will Be Apricots. And we'd like to thank Benjamin Alita Sainz for reading his lovely poem.
It was my pleasure.
I just want to make something perfectly clear right now. I'm putting down the law right now. The fact is, we are not just airing on Sundays on KTEP 88.5. We are also streamable and downloadable on multiple websites, not only on the KTEP website, which is ktep.org. But we're also on Podomatic.com. And if you go to Podomatic.com and search Words on a Wire, you will be able to find every single show we have ever recorded, from the very first one with Juan Felipe Herrera to the very last one with Jessica Sofer. And I say this because I was talking to Frank. Do you know Frank Perez?
Yes.
He's the chair of communications. And he says, oh, I missed your show this Sunday. I was really bummed. And I go, well, just go online. And he goes, oh, I could do that?
That's funny. And you can also find us on iTunes.
Yes, and Facebook. So, yeah, there's multiple ways to access us no matter where you are in the world. You could be in Spain. You could be in Timbuktu. You could be in Beijing, China. You could be in where else, Ben? Someplace really far. Las Cruces, New Mexico.
Yes, even in Las Cruces. So when you see us out on the street and say, sorry we missed your show, you didn't miss our show.
Yeah,
it's impossible to miss
exactly.
Our show. You can access our shows anytime you want. We are there for you anytime you need us.
And you can even listen to us on your iPhone.
So, again, thank you for listening to another edition of Words on
and
Wire.
And we'd like to thank our producer, Norma Martinez, for being so awesome and so patient with us.
And for being so organized.
Anyway, I'm Daniel Chacon.
And I'm Benjamin Alita Sainz.
Don't forget, the next book you read
may save your life.
I'm up on a tight wire. One side's ice and one is fire. It's a circus game with you and me. I'm up on a tight rope. One side's hate and one is hope. But the top hat on my head is all you see.